Distributing the Future broadcast April 10th, 2006, boot camp and video game music.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we feature a different sort of show. Both of our segments are produced interviews. Chris Adamson has a segment on music that you might be very familiar with without knowing it. Music from video games. But first, we'll look at Apple's Boot Camp, their new software that allows you to boot your Intel Mac into Windows XP. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call, so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. This past week, Apple released a public beta of software called Boot Camp. Boot Camp allows you to run Windows XP natively on your Intel Mac. When macOS 10 Tiger software update 10.4.6 was available, longtime Mac watchers knew that there's something new about to drop. Most expected a new Mac or iPod. No one seems to have expected this. If you own a copy of Windows XP that's covered, you can install Boot Camp and then have a dual boot machine. In other words, when you start up your Mac, you can choose whether to boot into macOS 10 or into Windows XP. O'Reilly senior editor Chuck Toporek explains that it might have been the recent contest for hackers that pushed Apple to release Boot Camp.
The announcement that came out on Tuesday, Apple clearly said, you know, this is something that we intended to have for Leopard, but hey, guess what? We're going to give it to you right now. And we're going to let you try it out. We're going to let you kick test it because we want your feedback. Have fun with it. Here you go. Here's Boot Camp. I think that was a smart move on their part. There was this little contest, you know, where people basically gave donations, and the first person who came up with a hack to install XP on an Intel Mac won like $13,000 or $14,000. But you had to do a lot of hacking on your system to do it, and it wasn't something for your average Mac user to do. You know, maybe Apple was looking at that, going, "Hey, you know, there's a potential risk here for people to really screw up their systems. We've got this thing that we've been developing. Let's just go ahead and put it out there and make things easier for people and take away that risk factor." I think that's a very proactive move on Apple's part.
So Apple has released a piece of Leopard early as a beta. Who's the target audience? Adam Goldstein, co-author of Switching to the Mac, The Missing Manual, thinks there are lots of reasons for a Windows user to take advantage of Boot Camp on a new Intel Mac.
I think that people are going to say, you know, "Oh, my PC's getting old. I don't want to wait for Vista next year. Let's buy a Mac, you know, for Christmas, bring it home and try out the software that we already have on it." And what I think is great about this also is that since it's not emulation, people's old software is going to actually run faster on their new Macs than it did on their old PCs. So people are going to get the benefit of first having a Mac, which is obviously good for Apple's hardware sales, but then they're also going to get the benefit of a faster computer, even though it's not running the Mac OS.
Online editor of Windows Dev Center, Preston Gralla, doesn't think this presents a risk for Microsoft at all. In fact, he says,
"For Microsoft, it's great. The more hardware that their operating system runs on, the better, especially if they don't have to do any engineering. Whereas Dell, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to Dell and all the PC makers. Again, though, I'm not sure that an enormous number of people are going to switch to a Mac because they could also run Windows on top of it. I think at the periphery, you might get some people doing it. The people I think you might get doing it are people right now, let's say, in corporate marketing or art departments or graphic design departments, audiovisual departments, who maybe are forced to use a PC because it's a corporate standard, even though they know for their jobs a Mac would be better. Those people, I think, will now be very happy because they'll be able to switch to the Mac. But for the vast majority of corporate users, I don't think it'll affect them. And I don't think it's going to affect home users to a great extent as well. I think that there's still a significant enough price difference between the Mac and the PC, and especially when you figure that if you buy a Mac and you want to run Windows, you also have to spend a few hundred extra dollars for an extra operating system. So I don't think it's going to affect a huge number of users other than certain people in the corporate market.
Adam thinks that the education market is another segment that's ready to use boot camp to begin bringing Macs back to schools.
I think that Apple was very clever to do this. A lot of tech people and even non-tech people in schools would like to use Macs because they're much easier to maintain. You know, they don't have to be patched every, you know, day or two and all that stuff. But they can't really do it because it's not what all the other schools are doing. So this will give them some cover to come in, put some Macs in, show people what they're like, and then every now and then maybe they'll restart them in the Mac OS instead of in Windows, and people will be like, huh, this is so much easier. And so it'll be sort of like a Trojan horse to get the Mac OS into the schools without starting up in them from the start.
Chuck says that there are many potential switchers who just have too much invested in Windows software that they haven't already been ready to make that jump yet.
People who, you know, have a Windows PC and have a lot of money invested in Windows applications. And some of those applications, you know, particularly if they're homegrown apps or, you know, apps that businesses have that they develop in-house that only run on Windows, you know, it gives them the option now to be able to have those applications available to their employees.
So why would a Windows user switch to Mac OS X with Vista finally less than a year away? Preston says he doesn't think they will.
I don't think that anybody who's waiting for Vista will instead go to the Mac. The truth is, I don't think a lot of people are actively waiting for Vista. I think it's more Microsoft wanting to get Vista out, and all the hardware makers wanting to get Vista out, and all the software industry, because it then gets people to buy more hardware and then more software as well. So I don't really think there are people who are saying, well, I'm going to wait to buy Vista. Maybe I'll buy a Mac. I think people are going to buy their Windows PC or a Mac-based PC, not based on Vista or not. So I don't think Vista enters into it.
Similarly, Preston doesn't think you'll see people switching in the other direction.
I don't think it's going to dramatically affect Microsoft one way or another, but they certainly could use it as a way to try to get people to actually make a switch. I don't think many Mac users will make a switch. The truth is, even though I'm a diehard Windows user, the truth is the Mac OS is superior to Windows OS, and so I don't think a lot of people are going to actually switch, but Microsoft could at least get a lot of new people to also use Windows, and for them, revenue is revenue. I mean, people on the Mac, if they want to use Windows, they're going to still have to buy a copy of Windows, so for Microsoft, it's extra revenue.
It may be that it's too subtle an issue. Does the average consumer understand the difference between their machine and the operating system running on it? Adam Goldstein says no.
There are a lot of people who don't even understand what an operating system is. And when Apple says, now you can run the Windows operating system, you know, in place of your Mac operating system, there are going to be a lot of people who just don't understand what's going on. And my guess is that a lot of people are going to call up Apple when they have problems running Windows on their Mac, and they're going to say, help us out. And Apple's going to explain to them that that's not the Mac operating system. They're just going to be totally lost.
Mac versus Windows is a religious argument. People have fought this battle over many different issues in the past. Chuck Toporek brings us up to date from the Mac side.
And, you know, that was the thing that Windows users were always saying, you know, is that, oh, Mac, it's just for gaming, you know, whatever. And now, you know, since OS X, you know, Mac's become a really serious platform. And I think a lot of people look at Apple and they look at OS X as, or the thing to have, and Windows is sort of like the buggy system that you use if you have to, or the buggy and virus-prone and spamware-prone system that you use if you have to.
Sounds like fighting words. If you're about to run Windows on the Mac, you do, however, need to be aware that you're now opening yourself up to some of these problems that Windows folks have been dealing with for years. Preston Growl is concerned that Mac people will be more vulnerable because they've gotten out of the habit of protecting themselves.
For the first time now, Mac people are going to feel the pain of spyware. When you run Windows on your Mac machine, you're going to be as vulnerable to spyware as if, I mean, you're really running Windows at that point. And so, therefore, one concern that I think Mac people are going to have to take into account is people who run Windows have gotten used to doing all kinds of things, buying a lot of extra software, taking a lot of extra security precautions, because Windows is targeted more by spyware and malware and is also more vulnerable to it. When they're running Windows, they're as vulnerable to it as anybody. Now, it looks like there won't be a crossover, that the spyware or malware won't be able to jump over into the Mac OS and hurt that part of things. On the other hand, it certainly can hurt the Windows part of things. And I think one extra thing that Mac people are going to have to worry about is that in Windows, you've gotten really used to constantly downloading patches and updating your operating system to make sure it's secure. And considering that Windows is going to be a second operating system, I'm not sure how many people on the Mac are actually going to do it. So theoretically, people on the Mac who run Windows may be even more vulnerable than most Windows users to spyware and malware, because they're not going to be used to all the things that they're being forced to do to keep their PCs safe.
Adam says that this is precisely one of the problems that Apple needs to be ready to face. If end users are confused about what an operating system is, will they understand where their problems are coming from?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably one of the potential pitfalls in the whole process, because obviously if it's running Windows all day, it's subject to the same security problems. But I think that there'll be enough interest in using Mac OS, either just by stumbling upon it because it's there, or because some of the people who are using the computer actually like to use it, that over time it'll encourage more and more people to use it. And just like, you know, having some inoculations in the population against the disease is a good way to protect everyone, I think having some Macs on the school networks will be a great way to sort of protect security in case the PCs go down.
In fact, he adds, there's a small chance that the viruses that sneak in on the Windows side could corrupt your data on the Mac side.
In theory, they could, but that in reality, it would be extremely difficult because the virus would have to write and read the files from the Mac partition in the Mac, you know, HFS format, which is apparently a pretty tough thing to do. Now, I mean, virus writers have proven that they're very clever. I don't know how much of a payoff there is to them to, you know, hack the few computers out there that are Macs running Windows.
What about the folks who don't really care about running Mac OS X? Chuck says there are limitations if you just want to run Windows XP on Mac hardware.
When you set up your partition for XP, anything over 35 megabytes, you have to format that partition as NTFS, which is read-only. Anything under 35 megabytes, you can set it as a FAT32, so it's read-write. So there's some limitations there. So if you're thinking of, you know, solely living in Windows XP on your Mac, think about how you're going to part out your drive and where you're going to store your files and everything else, and your app, you know, are you going to have enough room for your applications, etc.
And if you're going to run both Windows and Mac OS on the same machine, isn't it a pain to have a dual boot system? Adam says,
from Apple's perspective, it makes sense to have it as a separate boot, because as soon as it becomes possible to run Windows programs right next to Mac programs, then there's really not much of an incentive for any company at all to write a Mac version. But I think that from the end user perspective, it would be great to be able to run Windows programs next to the Mac programs, because, you know, especially for gamers and things like that, that's sort of the holy grail of the Mac experience. It's going to be an interesting thing to see, to, you know, play out, because Apple doesn't want you to be able to run them next to each other, because that would cannibalize all their, you know, development. But the end users do want to be able to run them next to each other.
At the point that the two operating systems run side by side, wouldn't Apple be introducing the risk that big developers would no longer develop for the Mac? Couldn't they just say, well, it runs on a Mac, an Intel Mac, running Windows, that is? Chuck says,
that's always a possibility, but then at that point you're also forcing your customers to go out and spend, well, I don't know what Vista is going to cost, but, you know, at the bare minimum with Windows XP, you're looking at, I think it's what, $199 for the Home Edition and $299 for the Pro Edition. So at that point you're going to, you know, if you're somebody like Adobe who's got the Creative Suite, that if you get the full blown out professional package, you're looking at what, $1,600 for the Pro package. And then you're going to force your customers to spend another $200 or $300 on a Windows operating system to go on your Mac, and then force them to configure their system and install it so they can run that software. There's a lot of what ifs in there, and people might just say, you know what, screw it, I'm not going to go with that. And they might start looking for other solutions.
In the end, Adam still sees Bootcamp as a great way of getting Windows users to feel safe about trying Mac OS.
Really, I think what the strategy is, and I think it'll be very successful, is that it's like a Trojan horse of the Mac OS that comes packaged on the computer, and it's there whether you use it or not. And so eventually, if your PC crashes or if you get a virus, at least you can boot up in the Mac and use that. And then, you know, maybe it'll just convert enough people over time that it'll get them using the Mac OS.
Trojan horse or public assault for a Windows user with an aging PC and a legal copy of Windows XP, the only cost of experimenting would be a $500 Mac Mini. And Mac users can play some of their favorite games on their favorite machines. Nearly 20 years ago, you could go see an orchestra perform music from the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes cartoons. Now you can go see orchestral performances of some of your favorite music from another unexpected medium, video games. Chris Adamson explains.
When Billboard magazine started tracking the top cell phone ringtones in late 2004, it featured artists like Usher, Snoop Dogg, and Koji Kondo. If you don't recognize Kondo, you might be familiar with his most popular work, the theme to Super Mario Bros. In fact, in the Billboard ringtone list for April 8 of this year, Usher and Snoop Dogg are gone, but Kondo's Super Mario theme has remained on the list for its entire lifetime, now it's 76 weeks. That's just one data point in a larger trend suggesting that video game music has gained popularity outside of games as a genre unto itself. This isn't news in Japan, where video game music is commonly released on multi-CD soundtracks, offered as printed sheet music, and performed live in concert by symphony orchestras. Now there are signs of game music rising in the West as well. Last year, 20 albums from the Final Fantasy game series made their U.S. debut as part of the iTunes Music Store. And last summer, a tour of music from Final Fantasy, called Dear Friends, played to sold-out symphony halls in Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, and other cities. Jason Michael Paul produced last year's tour. I spoke to him by phone from Japan, where he's making arrangements for a new video game music tour called Play. You produced a symphony tour of video game music last year. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I did the Dear Friends Musical Final Fantasy concert series. It was the first ever video game music concert series outside of Japan, and I did that with the distinguished orchestras all throughout the U.S.
What was the reaction to the tour like?
It was phenomenal. I mean, I got tons of fan mail. Everyone within Square Enix Nobuo Uematsu was very pleased. It was just phenomenal. I mean, people were coming from all over the world just to see these shows in some of the most distinguished orchestra halls in all over the world.
Now, can you tell us what this year's tour is all about?
Yeah, it's in the same format as Dear Friends, except for it's kind of what I've always dreamed of doing. It features a catalog of blockbuster video games and music. You know, the visuals, the music of games such as Chrono Cross, Chrono Trigger, Shenmue, Sonic the Hedgehog, Legend of Zelda, Super Mario Brothers, Final Fantasy, Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. The list really goes on and on. World of Warcraft, Morrowind. You know, we got the full support of the publishers. We have a lot of support from the composers. Nobuo Uematsu even composed the opening fanfare that'll be heard as the first song of every concert. Arranged by Arnie Roth, our music director and principal conductor.
Who do you think the audience is for video game music?
It's kind of something that's being determined every day. It's evolving, you know. I mean, it's really hard to pinpoint the audience. Sure, we reach our video game music, video game fans, but judging by the shows that we've done with Dear Friends, and we're kind of getting a mixed bag of folks, anywhere from an older, more seasoned classical aficionado, music aficionado, to a younger, a 10-year-old kid who's just a video game nut, or, you know, families for that matter. You know, families are coming to see our concerts. It's the reaction has been phenomenal. You know, I can't really say enough. These fans are great. They're smart. They're educated. They're just ecstatic. You know, I mean, the energy that you feel when you do these shows and these concert halls, it's just amazing. It's overwhelming almost. You really want to bend over backwards to give them everything that you possibly can because they're so appreciative.
What's the reaction been like among the symphonies themselves?
Well, it's been very positive. You know, obviously a lot of the symphonies are coming around very slow. They still kind of frown upon video game music. You know, it's not very typical yet, and it's something that's new. I mean, most orchestras are accustomed to playing Brahms and Beethoven and Strauss, let alone Nobuo Uematsu compositions or a Yasunori Mitsuda composition or a Kiriyama Okasan. So, you know, I mean, they're coming around, you know. I mean, obviously with the success of Dear Friends, it's becoming something that's being accepted by not only orchestras, but also mainstream folks.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about play?
This music is something that can be played in different styles, and that's what's cool about it, too. You know, I mean, you look at the Black Mages, Nobuo Uematsu's rock band, you know, battle music, Final Fantasy battle music. It's really interesting to see how this art is evolving and transforming every day.
Along with symphonies playing to thousands of patrons, video game music is making itself heard in many smaller places. Throughout the U.S., there are bands that are mostly or entirely devoted to playing video game music. Their names are almost always in jokes that only gamers will get. The Mini Bosses, the 1-Ups, Select Start, and the Spoony Bards, for example. What's interesting is how much the styles of all these bands diverge from one another. For example, the Mini Bosses play driving, hard rock arrangements of games from the 8-bit Nintendo era. Sounding entirely different, the Spoony Bards tend toward classical instruments like piano, violin, and flute, and often feature the vocal songs that emerged in the PlayStation 1 era. I spoke with Spoony Bard guitarist, pianist, and vocalist Stephen Poon via Skype following the group's recent appearance at the Anime Punch Convention in Columbus, Ohio. Can you tell us a little bit about your band? Who are you and what do you play?
Okay, we are the Spoony Bards, and we are just a group of musicians. We play a lot of video game and also anime music, and we go to conventions where we set up, and we will play for as long as we can. We'll pull all-nighters on Saturdays and play 24-plus hours of music, which is almost entirely by request. We just ask people for whatever they want to hear, and we'll play it. In addition to video game and anime music, we'll also play just normal music, show tunes, Disney, television, really anything people want to hear, because that's what we love to do. We just want to entertain everyone for as long as we possibly can and really lend this atmosphere to the entire convention. Because a lot of conventions, like usually most of the atmosphere is just the din of the crowd. And we really want to contribute this, you know, relaxing and even cheerful atmosphere where people can be walking around and all of a sudden hear their own character theme or hear something of a game or a show that they love. And all of a sudden we create that instant connection with them. And then it creates that instant connection with everyone in the room. Like we'll play the Mario theme and all of a sudden everyone will realize what's happening and start dancing or something. And it's really cool to be able to create that instant connection with so many people at the same time.
What made you decide to start a band that plays lots of video game music?
We didn't really decide to start a band per se. It began in terms of collaborative music, kind of when I met Jeremiah Roque at Anime Central 2004. And he was playing piano and I had my guitar with me. And he's like, oh, you play guitar. What do you know how to play? And one of the first things we did was Vamo a la Flamenco, which is from Final Fantasy IX. And we're like, hey, this is kind of cool. And we realized that the next day, the Anime Central, they took the pianos away that they have in the hotel. They have a couple baby grands, and we really wanted one to play on. So we thought, let's start a petition. So one of my friends that I met at Anime Central 2, Natalie Abdo, was with us, along with Veronica Henry, who sings. And then Jared's friend Andrew Estrada was there, and we ran into some other random guy named Ordo who plays violin. And we're like, let's just start playing music and get people to sign this petition. So we just started going through just all these video game and anime songs we knew how to play. And we're like, okay, we know how to play stuff from Xenogears. We know how to play stuff from Final Fantasy VIII, Final Fantasy IX. We all kind of know Mario. And just started kind of, and just started instantly playing together, having never tried any of this before in our lives. And it kind of snowballed from there. We just started meeting more people through the convention scene.
What's the reaction been like?
The reaction has been a lot more supportive than I ever imagined that it would have been. I am just absolutely amazed when I go to a con and then I'll run into people that know who I am and I don't know who they are. And it's really, we've met the most amazing supportive people. Like in my life, just at Anime Punch, there was an adult couple. Like they were there because their kids were at the con, and they just kind of hung out with us the entire time. And the next morning, you know, they realized that, you know, myself and Jeremiah were up all night, and they bought us breakfast. And I never would have expected that in my entire life that this would be happening. And I just absolutely love just how when people hear our music and if people will start dancing, people will start singing, people will start clapping and do whatever. And it has been very, it's been joyous. It's been excellent.
Is the interest in video game music a sort of nostalgia for 20-somethings, or do you think it's something else?
I think there are two different things. Nostalgia is a very big thing. Video game music definitely carries an enormous amount of nostalgia, not just for 20-something, but just mostly 20-somethings, but everyone that has grown up playing video games, that they'll hear something and it recalls that time that they were spent running through Midgar or the fields of Hyrule, and you know, all the memories of those in-game experiences, and also all that time that they had spent just, you know, on Saturday afternoons in front of the television playing games. But in addition to just the nostalgia aspect, but also from just a musical performative aspect of it. Like one of the other things that we really see as a goal for our music, besides the nostalgia that it brings, is that we really want to try to take this music and have it taken more seriously as a valid form of music, because it comes in so many different genres and styles that we really want this to be appreciated just as much as any other song.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the band or video game music in general?
I can say that I am really glad that video game music has been getting a lot more attention lately. This is attention that it really deserves, and hopefully that people will start taking it more seriously and appreciate it as it should be.
As video games have evolved from simple shooters to vibrant online communities and epic stories, game music has developed more sophistication and emotional import. Perhaps it only makes sense that gamers who've grown up with the music of Zelda, Mario, and Final Fantasy would increasingly adopt it as the soundtrack of their lives. And in doing so, they're treating it as music, listening to it, performing it, and adapting it to new styles. Like movies and television before it, video games are having an enormous cultural impact, and the proof may be as close as your headphones.
Adamson's look at the music you know and love from video games. Thanks also to Chuck Toporek, Adam Goldstein, and Preston Gralla. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who've emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.